Hey everybody, George here, and I want to give you a heads up. Last week, we released the cover of our new issue, Spring 2015, Issue 7. It has Cristiano Ronaldo on the cover, which is going to make half of you very excited and really upset the other half. I'm sorry. The Howler team is really excited about it, though. We have Wesley Schneider talking about the changes that Jose Mourinho makes when he comes into a new club. We have a feature on the last days of Chivas USA. We have a profile of Eric Winalda, who, in my opinion, is one of the more interesting figures in American soccer. We have a huge package on the history and personalities of FC Barcelona, and I do not say huge package lightly. It is at least 16 pages. We have a deep, deep dive on Miami Beckham United. That is the partnership between David Beckham and Simon Fuller, the American Idol producer, and a guy named Marcelo Claure, who is a really interesting person. He worked for the Bolivian Football Federation when the country made it to the 94 World Cup, and then he went on to make a fortune in the cell phone business. He's now the CEO of Sprint, and our reporter, Robert Andrew Powell, made a trip to Bolivia and then to Kansas City, where Claré now lives, because that's where Sprint's headquarters is, in order to report this story. Longtime listeners of Howler Radio will be familiar with Robert. He recorded our very first episode, which is called An American at Azteca, and his writing about soccer in Ciudad Juarez and about Hercules Gomez and Ray Hudson has appeared in the magazine before. It's that last piece I want to call your attention to now. We just put it up online yesterday. It appeared in issue 4, so it took us a while. It's one of the top things on our site, howlermagazine.com, and it is so, so good. Ray is a singular figure in this soccer culture of ours that we're all working to develop. And Robert spent an entire day with him, from hanging out at his home and then driving into the beIN Sports studios to prepare and then call a La Liga match. And then they drove back up 95 from Miami to Fort Lauderdale. And the picture you get of Ray is intimate and funny and a little bit heartbreaking in a real way, which is something that I'm just not used to in even the best soccer writing. So I would like you to go and check out that story. And I'd like to ask you to consider purchasing a copy of our new issue, which will be shipping in early March. We're really proud of the work that went into it. And if you like our podcast, I can pretty much guarantee that you're going to like the mag. Anyway, thanks for listening. On with the show.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out whoareyadesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code Dummy at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at whoareyadesigns.com.
Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler Magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I'm the editor of Howler, and I'm joined by two sad people, one of whom is in a closet for his own safety and the safety of those around him, and also for audio quality reasons. Danny Carvassian.
Hey,
Danny.
Hey, man. How's it going?
I'm better than you are. I can say that for a fact.
Yep.
Also joining us, Ishan Tharoor. You are a writer for The Washington Post. You used to be at Time Magazine. You cover international affairs. We also went to college together. But I think for these purposes, the fact that you're also an Arsenal fan is more important, and the fact that you're going to tell us about Qatar.
Hey, George. I'm in a closet as well.
You're in a closet of despair?
A metaphorical one and a genuine one here in the Washington Post newsroom.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Greetings.
You're in a closet within a closet. You're like, you took Danny and you just upped him.
The intros never cease to amaze me. Mine is still just like, he's in a closet in Miami. Welcome, Danny. And then today it's like, he writes for the Washington Post. He used to write for Time.
The only member of this podcast who has scored a goal for Arsenal. I'll remind everyone.
No, not today. There's no need to remind anybody today.
I would also like to point out, this is the first time, maybe in American soccer podcasting history, where three men of the subcontinent or close to it are all on the pod together.
Very exciting.
Very exciting, yeah.
We had an inauspicious start. Oxlade-Chamberlain almost got it back. We should say we're recording this minutes after Arsenal, in like the most Arsenal way, lost to Monaco in the first leg of the Champions League knockout rounds, round of 16. You guys are both kind of down about it. I understand. I thought it was not a very good game. Arsenal, what is there to say? I don't even think we need to go there. I do want to say we're going to talk about the Qatar World Cup, announcements about the tournament taking place in the winter. There's still human bondage in that country. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to get to Parma, which is going bankrupt and is kind of is very sad. So we're going to talk about both of those things right after we come back. Okay, kind of a bummer today, guys. We're going to talk about slavery, bankruptcy, and we've gotten your own personal miseries out of the way. Let's start with Qatar. There was big news in the last week. They've announced that it's basically a done deal. They're going to have a Winter World Cup in 2022. Guys, there are a couple of ways to go at this. The economic angle is probably the most interesting. That's the one that people seem to be, you know, the Premier League is complaining. Everyone's complaining because it's going to disrupt the season. Danny, take us through this. What exactly gets disrupted when teams are forced to take like a 7-week hiatus in the middle of the winter, especially the English winter, right? Because the English play through the winter as very few other leagues do.
Yeah, they do. And I think that's the reason it's probably the most concerning for the Premier League and for English football in general, is because there is no break. The winter period, late December through January, is kind of a traditionally exciting time in English football as well. So I think the fact that we've said the World Cup, they haven't set the exact dates, right? But they said November, December. I think, and I heard some rumblings that the final would be maybe on December 23rd. I read somewhere that there's about 100 games between November and December in the Premier League. That's a lot of games that would need to be rescheduled, a lot of games that would have to be moved to accommodate for the World Cup. So it does, you know, it does provide a kind of an interesting thing that the Premier League teams have to deal with here. And that's, you know, that's just the World Cup on its own. That's not to say all the preparation and everything that goes into it as well. You know, a lot of these teams like to have their players come in, you know, several weeks and a month or so in before the World Cup actually starts to get prepared for it. So yeah, I think it makes it kind of an interesting time. And other leagues in Europe are still playing in November and December as well. They do have, you know, they do have breaks, but they generally come just after that time period. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, but as the greatest league in the world, the Premier League will obviously be giving the most players to the national teams, right? So.
They will do. Yeah, I mean this in the well,
my joke went right past.
Yeah, you're joking. I know, but I was actually going to say that Sky Sports did a really good job of kind of breaking down exactly what, you know, I think a lot of people are just angry that there's going to be a World Cup in the winter, but they're not 100% sure why they're angry, apart from it's just breaking tradition. Sky Sports did a really good job, as I said, of breaking down what exactly this means for everybody. And the Premier League this past World Cup, the Premier League sent 106 players to the 2014 World Cup. And that was the most out of any of the top five leagues, with Serie A sending 81 and the Bundesliga sending 72 and La Liga 62. So obviously it has a very big effect, you know, on the Premier League. So that's, you know, I got the joke, but,
as someone who has experienced their own share of vague anger against FIFA, I can sympathize with that viewpoint. I mean, Ishan, is nothing sacred? I thought the World Cup, right? This is the one thing, this is the thing nobody touches. And now it's in the winter. It's like, it's like Barca taking the name off their shirts. This is just the beginning of the end, right?
I don't think it's necessarily the beginning of the end. It does seem a bit sacrilegious to not have a World Cup in the summer. It seems a bit weird to disrupt, because, you know, it's not just a winter break. It's, you know, two and a half winter breaks or something like that, if you consider the span of the World Cup. So you're going to really disrupt the seasons for a lot of the European leagues. You're going to do crazy things to conditioning and fitness for players who don't go to the World Cup. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. FIFA's argument is that, look, you have 7 years to figure this out. Another argument is that there are plenty of other leagues elsewhere in the world that always have to readjust every 4 years for a Summer World Cup. I'm thinking, say, you know, the Brazilian League. So there is a Eurocentricism to some of the reactions that I think we should caution. That said, obviously, the the larger narrative of Qatar getting it in the first place is still worth discussing.
You know, it's a little bit disheartening to see this kind of uproar over something that's going to disrupt basically what amounts to a business model, if you want to get really cynical about it. When, you know, we've had reports for over a year now of forced labor, slavery, you know, workers dying, people being basically stranded in Qatar, and forced to work in just really terrible conditions. Ishan, can you take us a little bit through the system? You know, there's a name for this system. It didn't start with the World Cup, but it's certainly coming to prominence, I'd say, more than any other time because of the construction going on there now. Take us through what's going on, and what that's called, and sort of what do you know about that?
So the system you're talking about is called the Kafala system. It exists in various forms across the Gulf region in these emirates. If you look at, you know, a lot of these countries, you know, the UAE, Bahrain, Qatar, you have a lot of countries where the ratio of citizens to migrant workers and expatriates is one where, you know, I think in Qatar only one-fifth of the country is actually of Qatari citizenship. So you have the society where that's built on the labor of migrants from elsewhere. And the kafala system is this program that brings in labor from, by and large, South Asia, often also the Philippines and other parts of Southeast Asia, on kind of contracts and deals where they have to surrender their passports. They're kind of obligated to work for a period of terms with various employers, and their rights and their ability for redress to grievances in Qatar is very limited. So this has led to all sorts of abuse in various stages of the process, from middlemen who bring these workers over to the employers to other elements of the state. And you know, you have these appalling, you know, stories of neglect, of miserable conditions, of workers, you know, dying from cardiac arrest often. I think the statistic that's been trotted out last year by The Guardian was that there are a lot of migrants from Nepal who work in Qatar and other parts of the Gulf. And that, I think the statistic was something like one every two days. I mean, there's a Nepali death every 2 days. And largely from cardiac arrest and improper working conditions. Not necessarily entirely because of specific construction sites that are related to the World Cup. But the point is that this entire epic construction binge that Qatar will go on for the World Cup, they're going to be building, you know, whole new, like, landscape constructions to building whole new cities, is going to be done on the backs of migrant labor from elsewhere. And the Qataris have, you know, promised better reforms and said that this is going to be a pedestal by which they can, you know, prove that they're improving and that they have built in better protections. But, you know, the proof is in the building and in the pudding, you know. So we'll see what happens.
Qatar, in some ways, seems like a leading, much more liberal voice among its neighbors. You know, Al Jazeera is based there, and that network has covered some of the uprisings in other Arab states. And yet, it seems this is a very much a conservative approach to you know, they haven't reformed this, it seems, at all. And so I'm wondering, is there a contradiction there? Is it more complex than the way I'm framing it?
Yeah, I would say, you know, first of all, this labor system exists in various forms, you know, in Saudi Arabia, next door, in the UAE, Qatar. It's not a uniquely Qatari practice. And secondly, you know, it isn't necessarily that liberal a state. Qatar is, per capita, one of the wealthiest countries in the world. It has a lot of natural gas oil reserves and has been, you know, basically, they don't have to do very much because they're sitting on all these energy resources. And what's interesting, and you point out Al Jazeera, yeah, what's interesting about what the Qatar has done compared to, say, other countries in their region is that they've promoted certain movements, certain political, conversations that other countries wouldn't particularly frown upon. So, for example, when the Arab Spring happened in 2011, and I don't know how much you want me to go blabbering on about this, Qatar distinguished itself as this country that was friendly to political Islam, was encouraging democratic Islamist movements elsewhere in Tunisia, in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood, and it was seen as this kind of interesting change agent in the Middle East, as opposed to, say, Saudi Arabia, which was, you know, a country that, you know, defends the Arab authoritarian kind of old guard. But in recent years, with all the chaos and the counter-revolution in Egypt and elsewhere, the Qataris have been a bit chastened. At home, it's not a democracy, it's an absolute monarchy. And they have similar conservative laws regarding dress, regarding, you know, obviously the consumption of alcohol and other such things, which will be interesting to watch during the World Cup, as their neighboring Arab states. So I wouldn't really champion Qatar's liberalism too much. Al Jazeera, as you point out, is a very interesting subversive network in many places, but it's still an instrument of the Qatari state.
When was the last time the World Cup was? It must have been 1978, right? The last time the World Cup wasn't held in a democracy. That would have been Argentina.
I guess so. Yeah.
The African Cup of Nations is meant to be that January in 2023, and I know how much we love talking about that this year. So, what's going to happen to that? That's my question. If we're still on Howler in 7 years,
what is that supposed to mean?
We won't. I mean, when we are still.
No. Okay. So no, you're right. I'll be very upset if the World Cup infringes on the African Cup.
And the other thing is that, you know, we're talking about Qatar now, but I think there are a lot of other reasons why we may be talking about Russia in 2018 and the politics of that as well. So
I don't know what you're referring to, but okay. All right, guys. When we come back, we're going to talk about Parma and soccer teams that have $0.
Hi there, Matt here, recording this after a trip to the pub, so not gonna lie, I'm a little bit buzzed. So as per usual, I'm here to wax lyrical about our lovely sponsors, Who Are You Designs. This week I decided to do something a little bit timely. So the other night I was watching TV and I saw this music award show called The Grammys. And there was some guy singing a song, he had scruffy hair, his name was like Hozier or something. And his song that he was singing, it was about church. And I thought the word church kind of sounds like T-shirts. So I should totally sing a parody of that to promote Who Are You? And so I did. Take me T-shirts, I'll wear them every day for the rest of my time. Only take them off if I'm naked with my next wife, V-neck or crew neck. T-shirts for the rest of my life. Take me T-shirts, I'll wear them every day for the rest of my time. Only take them off if I'm naked with my next wife, V-neck or crew neck. T-shirts for the rest of my life. Okay, so I actually just listened back to that, and now I know why nobody ever wants to do karaoke with me. It's because I'm such an incredible singer, right? Anyway, so if you want to take me T-shirts, go to whoareyoudesigns.com and don't forget to use the promo code DUMMY. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Now back to George and the non-bad singing part of the show.
Okay, Parma and soccer teams that have $0. I have a lot of questions about this, and I don't think necessarily that you have the answers. I don't even think that people who have written stories about this have all the answers. I read a very interesting piece by Paolo Bandini in The Guardian about this. I'll just set it up as best I can. Parma has had three owners in the last year. When I say owner, I mean chairman, president, you know, guy who has a lot of money and is in charge of the club. None of them, it seems, have paid the players or the support staff. This is a team, I mean, my God, this was an excellent team not too long ago. We're talking, you know, Gigi Buffon, Fabio Cannavaro, and Lilian Thuram were all on the field at the same time for these guys.
Thomas Brolin.
Although, you know, I'm not sure how much there is to brag about that, to be honest, given his non-World Cup 1994 play. he was... Okay, anyway. 1999 UEFA Super Cup winners. Like, this was a serious team. And what's going on there seems just incredibly sad. And I guess the question that I have, and again, I don't know if we'll have the answer for this, but Is this just what's happening to the middle class of European soccer clubs as teams get richer and richer and the bottom, you know, I guess my inclination when I read about this is to make analogies to the US economy, because that's something that I am a part of and sort of know. And what I know is that as you know, wealthy teams keep getting wealthier and wealthier. The middle class is shrinking. Teams are falling out, or people are falling out of it. Is Parma just falling out of the middle class? Is that a completely crazy statement to make?
I think it's a pretty unique situation in some respects. It came out of nowhere in the first place, right? If I remember correctly, it was not a big club from a very tiny city. And it was pumped up by the money of the Parmalat dairy empire. But yeah, I think your larger point about how, you know, the fact that football is increasingly a sport of the haves and the haves not have nots is definitely true. We feel it in many kind of echoes. I mean, you see it, you know, with the transfer dealings, right? You know, with, especially in England, where you can see the full spectrum of the football league, with, you know, all these bankrupt, sort of very, very poor clubs in the lower tiers in the same Sky Sports column as Chelsea and Man City. First of all, yeah, it is a question of something, you know, like, you know, the vast inequities that you do see in the game. But it is also, I mean, there's also a whole bunch of dodgy things that happen with the club itself, and misgovernance and abuse and exploitation of clubs is also a narrative to watch out about.
Yeah, so there was a big tax bill, and Parma qualified for Europe last season, but they weren't allowed to take place, you know, sort of take their spot because they had this unpaid tax bill. But there is a story here about, you know, and Paolo does a great job of sort of recapping this in his piece. Girardi, the guy who came in, he was the first of the three owners this year, and he owned the club from the 2006-2007 season. The gross debts that year, 16.1 million euro, right? Which is, that sounds like a lot, but these days it's, the gross debt is 197.4 million euros. So under his watch,
wow.
I mean, that has just absolutely ballooned. Now, Paolo makes a good point that, you know, taken with its credits, Parma is only in the hole for 96.5 million euro. But even that is still, you know, a much bigger debt than the club had when he came in. Now, there may be, I would love to get an economist on this show. I'd love to get someone like Stefan Szymanski to come on and tell us, is that inflation? I mean, inflation in soccer just seems to happen so much faster than in any other sector of society. I don't know, Danny, when you see this, and you know, you're very close with a club that I think people associate with financial management, you know, sound financial management, Arsenal. I guess one of the things I always wonder is, do these big clubs look at their smaller brethren and think, you know, we have a stake in their financial health. We need to help them out. We need to make sure that everyone in the league is at least healthy because we are, you know, it's not a zero sum game. We can't totally defeat these people because we need to come back and have them be alive for us to beat them next year.
Man, that's a tough one. I don't know if all the, you know, all the big clubs are, you know, I think a lot of the big clubs have enough of their own issues to deal with, that they don't have to worry about, you know, everybody else. But I think there is definitely a soft spot in everybody's heart where you look at these clubs and you're kind of seeing these stories that are coming out on a daily basis now. Like Hernan Crespo's in charge of the youth team at Parma and said that his players don't have any hot water, I think, to shower with after training. And then, even today, the captain of Parma, Alessandro Lucarelli, came out and said that they can't actually wash their kits at training anymore, and they have to bring their own kits home to wash on their own. So I think it's more just shocking seeing how this is all kind of playing out, especially as you mentioned that the team finished sixth last year and did qualify for Europe, but they weren't granted their license, their UEFA license, because of that. That outstanding tax bill, I suppose, is what it was. And now they're rock bottom of Serie A, and the game this weekend, this past weekend was canceled because they weren't able to afford, you know, police and stewards at the stadium. And they're actually asking if they could play games behind closed doors, which the Federation, I think, is saying no to as well. But they continue to try to push on for the next game each and every time. And I think, they said that this weekend's game, I think they're going to do everything they can to, it's an away game, I believe they're going to do everything they can to either rent a bus to get there, or they said if the players need to drive, then they'll drive to the actual stadium to play the game. Which, as I said, coming from, you know, I guess being honored to work for a club like Arsenal, where the boss does a very, very good job of making sure everything's run the way it needs to be run financially, you know. And I think he gets – us as a club, we do get criticized at times because it doesn't always mean that we're going to be winning trophies. But from his personality and how he likes to run things, that's just – you know, that's how he does it. When you go from that to seeing a club like Parma, as you mentioned, who had Buffon, Cannavaro, Lilian Thuram, all these players, it's such a story to – they have such a storied history. Seeing a guy like Hernan Crespo, who in of himself is a legend, saying that his players don't even have water to shower with after training, I think it's just sad, and everybody does have to take note.
There are things happening elsewhere. I mean, in Spain, everyone for a long time they've decried the imbalance in the TV money, and so there was even talk recently about the fact that the players might strike in order to get a more equitable split with Barcelona and Madrid to get a better share of the TV money. I mean, I'm all for actions like these that help teams, you know, stay afloat and pay their players. What I question is when a manager like Girardi comes in and the debt balloons under his management. I mean, that doesn't necessarily seem like it's just happenstance. It seems like this guy really messed up in some way.
Right, absolutely. And you saw, you know, something quite similar and similarly extreme with Rangers in Scotland. And yeah, I think, you know, the governance of the game is another massively important thing to look at. I think what's interesting about football compared to any other sports, especially sports in the American context, or at least the context of the United States, is that it's a much more kind of dog-eat-dog universe than what we have in the U.S. You know, especially when talking to Americans and explaining what something like, you know, what happened to Rangers or what's happening to Parma right now. I mean, people kind of are aghast by just the fact that there are no protections in place to make sure that owners are genuinely vetted, that there's no other protocol to bail out clubs in certain situations by the league. But that's the nature of football. And football, you know, I think there's a lot of hand-wringing about equity and about, you know, financial fair play. But even financial fair play, we're seeing it's not really, I'm not fully aware of the full extent that you guys have talked about it, but it doesn't seem like a foolproof system to create that much more parity in Europe. It's just the nature of this kind of sprawling sport where there's so many leagues and so many sources of competition.
Okay, a lot more to come on all this. I feel like we talk about the financial woes of these poor Argentines pretty much all the time, but we'll come back to it. When we come back, we will do Tiki Taka. So, guys, Tiki Taka, Danny, you're an old pro. I'm sure something interesting happened in Switzerland.
Actually, there was a really awesome goal in the Bundesliga. A goalkeeper scored, but I'm not going to be speaking about that. You guys can go look up. You can go look that up. But in Bolivia, in the Copa Libertadores, River Plate were playing a club called San Jose in a town. A small town in Bolivia, at 12,000 feet above sea level, obviously, because that's just where the Bolivians play. And, River Plate put together this concoction of Viagra, caffeine, and aspirin to give to their players to fight, the altitude sickness.
Let me just give one piece of advice. If you take a cocktail of, what is it? Viagra, cocaine?
No. Viagra, caffeine, and aspirin, which might actually be cocaine.
Just don't drive yourself to your game, okay? So, like, if the Parma players are hearing this, don't eat that and then drive up to Brescia or wherever you need to go.
But that was what some club medical guys put together to give to their players before the game to help them fight the altitude sickness. And apparently it didn't work because River Plate lost 2-0 anyway. So, but I just thought it was interesting that, you know, Viagra was being used for other
great
for other
flight
games.
Home. Like, yeah, flight
maybe
home.
Maybe it worked awesome. Afterwards.
All right. Okay. Okay.
Beat that.
You're a rookie, but you're going to have to step it up for this one.
I enjoyed Emmanuel Frimpong's tweets during the Arsenal match. They're worth checking out. He's just kind of angrily asking Arsenal players just to tackle people instead of playing football. But on a slightly more serious note, my favorite thing of the past week was the revelation that one of these Chelsea fans who was involved in that disgusting Paris Metro incident was seen posing, is a huge fan of UKIP, which is this kind of far-right nationalist British political party. And the British papers, The Guardian, of course, really ran with the story. They ran a picture of this Chelsea fan with Nigel Farage, who's the big bogeyman of British politics at the moment. And so it just kind of confirms to you, and this, I say this as a very biased Arsenal fan, it kind of confirms to you just all the concentrated odiousness of Chelsea Football Club.
All right. Okay, so my Tiki Taka is not funny. It's kind of sad, but it has a little bit of a personal thing. So just the recent news out of Greece is that the Greek Super League is suspended indefinitely because there's violence at matches, not just at matches. There's violence in like board meetings among the organizers of the league too. But just this past weekend, the two biggest Greek clubs played each other, Panathinaikos and Olympiakos. There was violence. And I care about this because not just because I'm a soccer fan, but I went there. There was this crazy footage of the 2000, I want to say the second fixture between these two clubs in the 2012 season. There was this crazy footage where Panathinaikos fans were just lobbing Molotov cocktails at the police, who were sort of surrounding the track at the stadium. And I could not believe what I was seeing. They called the game with like 9 minutes left in it and just stopped it. And so for the next one, I went to Athens and I made these little videos about, they're little documentary videos about soccer there, and I spoke to the fans who had been part of that crowd throwing those little homemade bombs. I spoke to some journalists. I spoke to some team administrators. I spoke to some players who weren't being paid. It was just a really depressing picture of what corruption. I spoke to a referee who quit being a referee. This guy was young, like in his early 40s maybe, because there was just too much pressure to throw games and to sort of be a dirty referee. And what I learned was that when the conditions get that bad, when these bad forces are able to sort of control things, everybody's miserable. Players, fans, journalists, the teams, nobody's happy. It's an incredibly sad state to be in. And it's really hard to fix because these are institutional problems that go beyond any, you know, you can't just fire somebody and the problem's solved, you know? And so while I'm very sad to see that the league has been suspended, I think that action is good. It's needed. And, I hope that's a good sign. I'm going to try to get, a guest in the near future, someone that I met and actually interviewed for those videos onto the podcast. But for now, I just wanted to call attention to this because it's the kind of league that it's easy to ignore. It's hard to find news about this. People just don't cover it very well, but it matters to people there the way that any league matters to its fans. So, I just wanted to call attention to that. And, that'll end a pretty depressing episode of Dummy.
George, just to let you know, I used to, I went to Greece twice, actually, before, I was thinking about maybe doing something with, Arsenal have an academy over there, and I nearly took a position as like an academy, the head of the academy over there. We have a full-time residential academy there. And, I'd never been to Greece, and I went to Thessaloniki and, a small town where Arsenal's, the actual academy was at the time was called Loutraki. And as you said, like, it's like you just don't understand how passionate people are about their own leagues until you go there and you see. And like, I'd known about Greek football, from the big clubs, basically, like Panathinaikos and Olympiakos and PAOK and stuff. But until you're there and you see just what it means to people, man, it's crazy. So I'm sure they're hurting right now.
Especially in the current context, what's fascinating about Greek politics as well as Greek football, and it's echoed in Greek football, is how polarized and politicized a society Greece is. I mean, the way you have really genuine, like, militant leftist groups, militant right-wing groups in the country, and that kind of that sense of contest and clash is everywhere in the country. You have this very long tradition of anarchism and violence that plays out in the football stands as well. And you have, you know, a lot of the heads of these football clubs, Panathinaikos and Olympiakos, are part of the kind of old corrupt establishment that's brought Greece to the kind of financial mess that it is in right now. So it's this kind of one incredible toxic combination of forces.
Yeah, I mean, and the politics really is linked. I mean, Golden Dawn people, you know, and the Greek, this episode where some Greek fans really were pretty terrible towards some Albanian fans. You know, these things are certainly linked and fascinating. But, you know, you're also looking at a country that is under more pressure than it's really ever been under. I mean, you look at the society and it's really bearing some incredible weight right now. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that tend to happen, I guess, but it's really hard to watch. All right, guys, let's leave it there. we'll be back with some happy, fun news next week. I'm make sure of it. We'll try it. We'll find some. Guys, Danny, Ishan, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much. Yeah.
That does it for this episode of Dummy. I want to thank Ishan Tharoor and Danny Karbassian for joining me. Check in with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, where we are at What a Howler. Who Are You Designs is our sponsor. They sell a Dummy t-shirt, which I encourage you to wear ironically. Or give it to a friend who doesn't listen to the show, because that would achieve two things. A, you're labeling them a dummy, which is evident by the fact that, you know, they don't listen to the show. And B, you're letting them know about the show. So if they want to improve themselves, if they want to become slightly less dumb and a little more ironic while wearing the new shirt that you just bought them, they know exactly what to do. Either way, if you do buy anything from Who Are You, I think you should use the promo code DUMMY at checkout, because then the shirts are a shippin' and the shippin' is free. The Howler Singers are led by Lindsay Elliott. They are members of the choral ensemble Ghostlight, and they made our theme tune. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. Our production team is Matthew Nelson, Ryan Catanese, and Kira Deppenbrock. My name is George Qureshi, telling you that if you listen to Dummy, you will never listen alone.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are You? Check out WhoAreYouDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are You has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's DUMMY. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYouDesigns.com.